Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax in the squeaky chair.
and a very, very harried, angry David Bax.
Yeah.
Because you're the dad here.
I guess. Yeah. Well,
we got a room full of kids running around.
Well, I'm also having a bad day, but let's not talk about that
Indeed.
On the podcast.
Indeed.
Let's talk about by whom this podcast is brought to our listeners.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
We got there. Good for you. This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated online cinema that brings its members a handpicked selection of the best independent, international, and classic films. Every day, Mubi's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $8.99 a month. Plus, when you use their mobile apps, you can download films to watch offline. Currently available on Mubi is Lee Yang's Blind Mountain. Following Mubi's Chinese independent documentary series, similarly politically impassioned reckoning with human trafficking in modern China. It is not an easy watch, but it is a necessary, nuanced expression of dissent against the powers that be, guided by a remarkably humanist lens. So you can check that out at Mubi, and there's a special offer for listeners of Battleship Pretension. You can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com, that's MUBI.com/battleship to redeem now, or you can go to BattleshipPretension.com and click on the Mubi ad on the left-hand side. And just wanted to put this out there that Mubi continues to exist. It doesn't need some bullshit petition to come back. It just is.
It doesn't need Bill Hader.
Exactly.
Guillermo del Toro rallying behind
right.
it.
It
Mubi
has,
soldiers on.
Exactly. It's going to be just fine. Okay.
Okay. By the way, Filmstrike did sponsor like multiple Comic-Con meetups for us. We should probably not dance on their grave.
Perhaps if they had sponsored the show, maybe more people would know about them. Look, the point is, it's not about market failure. We are talking about Mubi and their eternal flame. Okay. But anyway.
By the way, I have not seen Blind Mountain.
Okay.
But I have seen Blind Shaft.
Okay.
Which, when you were talking about, I was like, wait, is that that movie? And so I like Googled it real quick and I was like, no, Blind Shaft, which is by the same director.
Oh, okay.
I guess he has a...
He's got a thing for blind things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a Jeremy Saulnier in Colors thing, you know?
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does he has one coming out, right?
Hold the Dark already came out.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forget about that.
I'm looking at our guests. They don't know. They're not paying attention to the...
Okay, one of them is nodding too impassioned. I feel like you just don't know, but you're affirming. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, so this episode is also brought to you by the Dice Enthusiasts Presents podcast, a new series based around a board game that four roommates played for the entirety of 2017. During that year, they were faced with problems like drug dealers moving in with them, mental breakdowns, infidelity, and a suicide attempt. A surprisingly personal podcast, Dice Enthusiasts Presents, is a prime example of life happening while you're making other plans or trying to play a game. Go to DiceEnthusiasts.com or click on the ad at BattleshipPretension.com to listen.
And I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day of our lives. Tyler, do you know what I listened to today?
What's that?
This is up your alley.
Okay.
Because I know you're a big fan of this band. And I realized that at 36 years old, I feel like I've absorbed this. Like... What's the word people use? Like,
I don't know what you're trying to say.
Anyway, just through the culture I've resorted, I know some of the songs, but I realized I don't think I've ever sat down and listened to The Wall from beginning to end.
All right.
But I've seen the movie, so like that counts, right? But no. Okay.
No.
So I actually listened, while I was at work today, I listened to all the hour and a half of The Wall. And I was
that is going to inform your day.
Yeah.
The mood of your day.
I like Pink Floyd, but I think I like Piper at the Gates of Dawn. I think The Wall is like, I think I kind of realized like, all right, I know the songs that I know for a reason, and the rest, there's a lot, I feel like filler in The Wall.
Yeah, I mean, it's still entertaining, but yeah, there are the definite songs, then there are these sort of transitional bits of music that are still, that I think are still very effective, but they are effective in the context of the entire album.
Yeah.
As opposed to like comfortably numb.
Right.
I went to,
we were going to go together and I can't remember what I had something come up.
That I did not go. Unfortunately. Okay. In retrospect, I wish that I had, I did see Roger Waters, at Desert Trip, but he was performing various, Pink Floyd songs, but there was a big,
did he do solo stuff? Like,
not that I'm aware of
the song that he wrote for The Legend of 1900.
Not that
I remember that movie.
I do remember the movie, but no, I don't think so.
He wrote a very bad song.
Oh,
that reminds me. We'll get back to the ad in a second. Look, everyone loves The Americans. It just ended, but there's an Americans episode in season two that has an original song by, I want to say it's Pete Townsend.
Okay.
And I feel like what happened was Pete Townsend was like, hey, I'm a fan of your show. Let me write you a song. And they were probably like, oh, fuck, this would be great. Like, yeah. An original Pete Townsend song for the show. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And yet they, like, had to use it. And so my wife and I watched that. Like, it's the only American episode she's watched. There's a reason she's never watched another one, because she associates that show with this song now. We watched it once. We will sing this song to each other sometimes to make each other laugh. It's so bad that we remember how the song goes.
It is.
I was not going to sing.
Don't sing it, but lyric-wise, how does it go?
No, the main, like, each verse ends with the line, and it must be done. And so that's what we would just sort of sing that to each other.
That also, by the way, seems very Roger Waters-esque. Certainly.
Yeah,
And I do remember that at his performance in Desert Trip, it was October 2016. So, you know, of course he had very strong political opinions.
Which way is he going?
He was really in favor of Jill Stein. So, but it was really funny just to hear like how anti-authoritarian, like the Desert Trip crowd was. Like at one point, you know, there's the song Mother from The Wall. It goes, Mother, should I trust the government? And everyone, and then like the screen behind him says like, fuck no. And then like, all the people like, woo. And part of me is like, you guys are going to qualify for Social Security soon. You better start trusting the government because it's going to be on your side. But anyway,
you can listen to all the Roger Waters and Pete Townsend you want on your tweakedaudio.com earbuds, because it's all going to sound great. And they're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So I'm going to bring our guests because we have a fun topic to get to, but there's also something in the news that I want to talk about.
Which
reminded me of
which one? Which part?
None of the terrible, terrible parts.
Okay.
Or the very good things. Some very good things happened this week too.
Sure.
But our guests, they've been on the show before. It's been too long in both cases. Mm-hmm. Well, Jake was on the, commentary, so I feel like I just saw you. But Kristen Sales and Jake Bart, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah. That word you were thinking of, I believe it was osmosis.
Osmosis, yes. Is the word. Oh, like Osmosis Jones.
Yes, the very same.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which also does feature a song by Roger Waters.
Every word is a movie.
Yeah.
Osmosis Jones, it must be done.
That's the sequel.
Are you guys Americans fans? That wasn't what I was going to ask.
If we talk about Kerry Russell, Jake's going to have to leave the room. Well, so
it is a little warm in here, and it just got a little warmer.
I'll say I've never seen an episode.
I've seen the first season, and I am continuing to watch it. It's very good.
No, the thing I wanted to talk about, Jason Blum getting
yes
getting booed off the stage
for
making anti-Trump comments at the Israeli Film Festival here in Los Angeles the night.
Yeah,
do you guys follow? Are you,
I did see that.
Did you guys see this?
I don't know what any of these words are.
Do you know who Jason? Oh, it's Blum,
it's
isn't it?
Blum. It's Blumhouse. That guy.
The Blumhouse guy. He was being given like an honorary thing, and it was, I think it was on election night on Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
So he was saying some political stuff and some anti-Trump stuff, and he got booed like crazy and ended up being escorted off the stage.
Yeah.
The, now, I got, because I'm a member of the cinematic press, I got a press release from the Israeli Film Festival saying we did not force him off stage. There were audience members approaching the podium, and we had him removed for security reasons. I don't know if that's true, if that's covering their asses, but that is that's their story.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? You think, isn't Los Angeles a safe space?
I mean, I like how you combine the politics with Israeli Middle Eastern issues, but I mean, we'd like to think that Los Angeles is this liberal enclave, but obviously there is a certain amount of conservative thought in the Jewish community that is very in favor of what Trump is doing in Israel.
Right. So I'm sure that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah.
At all.
I'll bet Jason Blum was surprised, though. I'll bet he thought, I don't think he thought it was like, I'm
really?
Going to torch this place. I bet he thought, like, this was like being at the Golden Globes or whatever. Yeah. I'm going to get a standing ovation by talking shit about Trump. And
I mean, know your audience, man. I don't, maybe he just decided to do it anyway because he thought it was the right thing to do, but right. I'm not surprised.
As you were describing it, because, yeah, I did read that article, and it got me thinking that wouldn't it be interesting if somebody was not booed off stage, but they were, ugh, off stage. So like the entire crowd just collectively goes, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. But yeah, that is, now why do you delight so much in that? Like, why is that to you good news?
Because the narrative, I don't know if I said it was good news.
Well, it wasn't the sad stuff.
It wasn't the very bad stuff that has happened this week. No, I think because of the narrative that I have written of him being confident, Kristen disagrees with me. She thinks it was a knowingly ballsy move. I'm saying it's comedic to me to imagine him being like strutting up to the stage. Oh, yeah. Like I'm about to bask it. Soak.
Here I am to get all this praise.
I think it's really a psyop based in the fact that he took all that heat for not being able to apparently find a woman filmmaker.
Right.
Oh,
you know,
because
you need to hunt. apparently he couldn't find a female filmmaker, but now he's like this progressive.
Yeah, he's like Mr. Woke now.
Yeah.
Woke House.
They should change it to that.
Yeah. They should.
Yeah.
Jason, if you're listening.
Oh, this is fun. I'm so glad we have you guys on the show. Listeners probably have guessed why we have you on the show if they listened to last week's episode, because we came up with the idea for this week's episode on last week's episode.
And undoubtedly they were listening and they thought, gosh, I wonder who they're going to get. They heard one of the names and thought, damn. And then the other, like, yeah, all right, that's fine. I'll let you guys decide. I'll let the listener decide who of our guests I have an intense dislike for.
So, Tyler and I were talking about it. We got here in a weird roundabout way from the end of the LA Film Festival. Yeah. I'm not going to go through all that again. The listeners heard it. But we were talking about the idea of film fandom as a community. And Tyler and I tend to not only not be a part of that community, I tend to also be very skeptical in general. I'm, you know, sort of reflexively not a joiner in general. And so I think Tyler and I wanted to have some people on who have more experience, if not necessarily more positivity about the community.
Why are you looking at me?
I'm looking at our guest who is a former member of Film Twist. But I remember, I remember last year about this time, our collective friend Scott, editor at large of Battleship Retention, Scott Nye. He and I were IMing about the AFI Film Fest, and I was like, oh, I'm really looking forward to this movie, April's Daughter. Or April's Daughters is weirdly the Spanish language translation. I don't know why they made it. She has multiple daughters in the movie. I'm not sure why they the English language one made it singular. But anyway, I was like, oh, I'm looking forward to this movie, April's Daughter. I like the director. He made this movie after Lucia. And Scott was like, oh, yeah, Film Twitter hates that guy. And I spent, like, the rest of the week just so angry about, like, oh, so Film Twitter has just come to a fucking consensus, huh?
Yeah.
Like, oh, or am I not allowed to like this guy? I got, like, disproportionately bothered. And I think that's the thing that I tend to be skeptical about in communities is that they come to decisions together. Like,
and what's you were upset. You got upset at his characterization. It could be completely his interpretation Film Twitter's reaction to this filmmaker. But yeah. It is interesting.
Yeah, and I think I kind of joke about it when a celebrity is like on the outs. I'll say on this podcast, like, oh, we don't like Matt Damon anymore. Right. You know, because I'm saying it half jokingly, but there is I do really hate that feeling of like. I guess the mob mentality. Mm-hmm. And I think I maybe to my own detriment tend to overlook the positive things about a community of film lovers and focus on the negative outputs. So what do you guys feel about? Do you consider yourselves part of a community of film lovers or cinephiles or whatever?
Well, I have some bad news for you, David. You just qualified for Film Twitter by being angry about Film Twitter.
Okay. Huh.
So
okay.
Through the, all I guess, right. Is that the transitive property? Probably not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you are now officially part of Film Twitter.
I'll await
because you're mad. You're mad online.
Oh, it's a certificate. I am mad online, but you understand, we've been doing this podcast 11 years.
That's right.
Almost 12 years, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe Film Twitter is part of the fleet. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's it. We started Film Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, God, what a terrible...
So we know who to blame.
It's like Typhoid Mary over here. patient zero. I think if I recall correctly, and I don't know if I'm getting the details right, but I think the guy who did After Lucia is actually just like an asshole, so that's why people hate him.
Oh, okay, because I thought it was that he made that English language movie with Tim Roth that everyone hated.
No, Chronic. I think there was some sort of mini scandal or something about him going after like a review of one of his films, going after someone personally. And I hope that this is the case. If it's not, if I'm incorrect, I apologize. But
okay.
I do remember that happening because he was on Twitter at the time, the director or whatever, okay. And then it came out that he was kind of harassing people personally a little bit over his films. Mm-hmm. And so people kind of decided to be like, this guy's not cool.
See, and I was so quick to blame Film Twitter. I didn't stop to like learn that about him.
If I recall correctly, I think that is what happened. But so in this case, it may have been an instance of him kind of showing his ass online and then people saying like, ooh, actually we're real people and we don't appreciate this, you know, regardless of how your films are. Which I think I've maybe seen After Lucia, and that's it. So,
although, and okay, having not seen any of these tweets, because as much as David is not involved in Film Twitter, he's exponentially more involved than I am.
Yeah.
And so, but
here's the thing: in the film world, I don't follow anyone on Twitter that I have not met in person.
Oh, okay. That's probably a good call.
That is a rule, because otherwise I start to become a part of Film Twitter.
Yeah.
And they have to be, these are my film friends that I follow on Twitter, but I don't follow just anyone.
Yeah.
Whereas hockey, I follow everyone. Yes. I'm very much a part of hockey Twitter.
Does hockey Twitter actually exist?
Oh,
is it called that?
Yeah, everything has a
Twitter. Wait a minute. How have we not talked about Gritty yet? Gritty I'm sorry. I'm going to hijack this podcast.
Yeah, we can make it a Gritty podcast.
No, I just... Yeah, because I, you know, over the sort of hiatus or whatever, when I was like off Twitter and deleted my Twitter and like wasn't into movies at all, I got really into baseball. And so the only reason that I reactivated Twitter because I wanted to be part of Dodgers Twitter during the playoffs. And I was like, okay, so I'm going to refollow all these Dodgers Twitter. And then I was like, well, I guess I should follow my friends, and then here I am back
in Film Twitter.
Sort of. I mean, I'm only adding people that I actually know or like news sources that I want to get from. I don't think I'm on Film Twitter anymore, but I do have the ghosts of Film Twitter follow me everywhere.
Canon is that you are off film.
It is. I am officially off film. But, you know, the exception proves the rule, I guess.
Do you get a chip?
A chip in my 100 days sober from film? No, I've obviously broken my sobriety. I watched a movie last night. I mean, I'm not perfect.
But how's it? Look, I'm still on Gritty. I want to talk about Gritty.
Okay,
Twitter.
Sure. Yeah. No, I love Gritty.
Twitter has it has gone outside of just hockey now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's socialism Twitter. DSA has adopted Gritty as the workers' representative.
But that's also because doesn't he kind of look like one of the hosts of one of those insufferable podcasts?
I don't know what the narrative. I don't know what the origin is of DSA Gritty. I just know I love it. I know that one of my very best friends in the world made a homemade Gritty costume for Halloween, and she let me try on the mask, and it was gorgeous. I just love Gritty. He came to us at a time when we needed him, and he's been the hero that Gotham deserves so far this year. So Gritty is the only good thing about 2018 so far.
You know what? For someone who is actually is a part of Hockey Twitter and listens to hockey podcasts constantly, one of the great side products of Gritty is that stupid, like, hockey commentators can now have to use the word Gritty less because it's associated with the mascot.
Fantastic.
Whereas it used to be just the go-to, it's usually like guys who played the game and are now commentators being like, I like that guy, he's Gritty.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean anything.
He's a Gritty player.
Yeah. And I think that's why Gritty became the name of a hockey mascot, but I love that now.
That's very
have to use
that's
the
very
word
good. Is they have yeah. to they have to Gritty use
has
reclaimed now.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
I was looking up the Gritty Twitter account before you used the word mascot. And so imagine my surprise when I was faced with this bright orange weird looking thing. And then you said mascot. I was like, okay, I wish I had known that before I looked this up.
There's also the wonderful sort of coincidence or side meme of Justin Turner also being Gritty, like Justin Turner from the Dodgers being like a human Gritty. And so I don't know how that started either. I think everybody was just like, hey, Gritty. And so they would just, I don't know. I mean, he has so many nicknames, but for some reason, Gritty became part of Dodgers Twitter because Justin Turner has a big orange beard. I don't That's even great. Know, but it was wonderful.
So what I was going to say before things went...
sorry about that sidebar.
I don't know if we were ever really on the rails, but anyway, what I was going to say is the director that you're talking about, and the way you phrased it was he realized that as he was going after like critics that didn't like his movie or whatever, they're like, oh, well, we're people as well. But I think one of my issues with... To me, like, the negative stereotype, and I think it is a stereotype, and I don't think it's necessarily true, but it is true occasionally. The stereotype of the internet critic is that they are very trollish, and they are very smarmy, and they will be dismissive, whether it be in their reviews or on Twitter, of people. Like, they don't see the directors and actors that they are reviewing as people either. And so I think that tends to be why I am not... My limited interaction with film Twitter has yielded... it's confirmed my decision to not really be a part of it. I sometimes would find out about interesting movies, but... chances are I was going to find out about him anyway. And I didn't. And the tone of film Twitter was just something that was making me angry. Partially in the same way, as strange as it may sound, in the same way that I'm not part of Christian Twitter either, because there's a tone there. And in both cases, like, this is what I'm trying not to be.
Oh yeah.
And so while it's maybe good to see what that is so that you can know what to avoid, it also was really having an impact on my mood. And so I needed to move away from that. So I do think that there's any community, anytime, David, I think you were starting to head in this direction, like anytime people get together and they start making a decision as one, I feel like anytime that happens, the decision is going to be simpler simpler and probably more... more stupidly expressed than by an individual. And we started to talk about that last.
Yeah,
last week.
I mean, when film, I don't want to make this episode about film Twitter only.
Right.
I want to talk about other aspects of community, but I do think when film Twitter comes to a consensus about a movie, it tends to be just the middle of the Venn diagram, you know, and all the other stuff gets kind of shaved off, or maybe they lean towards the hotter take or whatever. But I don't just want to talk about the negative, and I do want to talk about positive things about being a part of a community. You guys, what are they? I don't know.
I guess there are
we'll talk to Smiley over here.
Yeah, there are two broader points that I just want to inject into kind of what we're talking about here. And one thing is, even as a term used on Twitter, film Twitter doesn't really mean anything. I mean, because we're talking about a community, or quote unquote community, that can somehow include sort of the bloody disgustings, the badass digests, the
birth movies, like a decade,
whatever. My point is, I was never reading those.
Yeah.
Right. I'm part of film Twitter. Likewise, they are part of film Twitter. But like it includes,
so like, MCU fans and people attending the Locarno Film Festival both consider themselves film Twitter, but have almost nothing to do with it.
And almost never interact, because of course that's one of the features and one of the drawbacks of sort of tailoring your online community is you can sort of filter out some noise and only cater to certain things you want to see. The other thing is, I found, at least engaging on Twitter, there is also the possibility for sort of unheralded movies to sort of gain a low level following. You know, I was a huge fan of Rules Don't Apply.
Yeah,
and there's like seven or eight other people I follow on Twitter who I know are ride or die Rules Don't Apply Hive.
Here's the benefit of not being a part of the community. If you're like me, you live in a world where you can assume everyone loves Rules Don't Apply as much as it deserves to.
But you could also come on film Twitter and talk about Rules Don't Apply with the people who like to make Rules Don't Apply jokes.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful part of your day.
Okay. It is.
That's the kind of benefit, is because what Jake's talking about is that film Twitter is a niche of a niche of a niche, and there are niches within that niche.
It's up its own ass.
And a lot of it is just joking around. Uh-huh. Just memes, just people like killing time at work, talking about, you know, posting funny GIFs and stuff. Like, to me, that's a lot of what film Twitter is. And then there's like the nonsense, or if there's a terrible take, if IndieWire prints something that's ridiculous and then people get mad about it. No, that would never happen, obviously. That was just an example. But
they do the top 30.
No, they're a fantastic publication. There's nothing wrong with
the 21st century.
IndieWire is a bastion of indie film. There's different levels, and what Jake's saying is that you definitely choose what you want to listen to and who you want to engage with, and that is up to you, at least on the Twitter sphere. Part of the reason I deleted my old Twitter and reactivated and then just added people I wanted to listen to, because I could not go through, you know, 2,500 people and weed out who I didn't want to listen to. Also, right. I didn't want to like say like, hey, you suck and I don't want to listen to you anymore. You choose how to use it, the technology, and you choose to engage with what you want to. And
just double checking to make sure you don't follow me, so that's good.
Oh, okay. You only tweet about hockey.
That's true.
There's not enough gritty content.
One of the benefits, and we can get off of phone Twitter and move on to a different part of the community, but I think one of the important things that film Twitter does is bring conversations into the forefront that may not have been there, or may not be getting as diverse input as they would have been otherwise. And I'm thinking a lot about what happened in the entertainment industry in general over the past year, in terms of scandals, in terms of kind of getting rid of or exercising these sort of demonic or predatory figures in the industry, not just in the studio system, but also in the repertory cinema scene, especially in Los Angeles, and everything that happened with CineFamily, rest in piss. And I think it was really important to have those people sounding off on Twitter and sharing their stories and kind of collectively coming together to talk about something that was sort of known but not exposed, and working together to expose it and to let people know who didn't know what was going on, let them know that this was happening, and to organize and to form alternative communities and other groups and stuff in response to that. And so
this covers what you said, but each one of those people who has had these experiences knows they're not alone, or not knows.
They find each other. They talk about people. They talk about what their experiences. When that whole thing was going on last summer, last fall, I had a lot of people talk to me about various different experiences that they'd have. And there were sort of side organizations formed, especially among women, to sort of talk about maybe various issues that we've been dealing with and how can we move forward? How can the women who enjoy going to repertory cinema reclaim that space after everything that had happened, and where can we find, how can we organize and put things on ourselves or influence programming that way? And I understand that that's a very micro niche within the Los Angeles area and within a couple movie theaters, but I think that was, I would say, a benefit of Film Twitter. But the downside of that is obviously getting extremely burnt out on a never-ending cycle of disappointing news where you learn that, you know, there's horrible things happening to people in your community all over the country and the world. So that,
and by people you thought you liked or thought
exactly you just this kind of this, and I feel like that sort of impotent rage and disappointment is kind of now the national mood. So I feel like it's a little bit navel gazing to just say like, oh, I feel bad because this thing happened in this community. But I feel like now everyone kind of understands what it's like to just feel like angry all the time. Mm-hmm. So I welcome all cis men and all other people to join women and other minority groups and just feeling really angry all the time. And
Don't tell me what to do.
and trying to make it better. But I did notice that. So that's my only good, not the only good thing, but, because I wouldn't have met Jake if it wasn't for Film Twitter.
Yeah.
So, and now we're real life friends,
that's
ladies and
not
gentlemen.
True.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
You would have met through Battleship Retention.
That's true,
That is true, but we had already met, and I was already firmly established as the little brother she never wanted to the big sister I never asked for.
Yeah, that's true. He was stalking me on Twitter, and I was like, why is John Ford following me? And then and then I realized you were like a real person and not like a creepy old man from the Midwest. It was like, fine.
I mean, I am from the Midwest, but
and you are a creepy old man.
But, right, this is true.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, for me personally, it is a community in the sense that I have utilized the online community to actually make real life friendships that are like very meaningful to me. And I would recommend that people try to do that and try not to get subsumed in the like never ending torrent of discourse, quote unquote, and also just people expressing their insane outrage at every little thing, because I think that really like rots your soul. So I would try to just get people to focus on like trying to make friends or hanging out or doing something positive.
Well, and that's part of, I mean, you brought up a lot of good points, but part of the whole organizing that you were talking about around CineFamily also highlights the fact that as sort of a community or a set of communities, Film Twitter can be very regional. And unlike Kristen, I actually moved to LA not too many years ago, didn't know a single person, and really it was a great way for me to just get to know people like Kristen and meet them in person and actually be around other people who really cared about movies and who wanted to talk about movies and can talk about other stuff like Gritty. And yeah, I mean, I think as a resource in that way, it can do some good.
Yeah, it's all about how you, I think, just like any other platform, it's all about how you use it and the attitude that you go in to it with. So, yeah.
Yeah, it would seem that not that the word community here should be a dirty word. A community is a very good concept. so I almost wonder if maybe we should use a different word, almost groupthink or something like that. But
no, because I want, that's the reason I wanted people other than you and me, mm-hmm. a couple of cranks on.
Yeah.
Jake's kind of a crank too, but
you've read my Twitter.
Was because I don't just want to talk about the negative aspect.
Right.
If it were just you and me, this would be, it would be, it would be the sourest episode of Battleship Retention, which is saying something.
Yeah, I definitely have more to say about, to the extent that such a thing exists, film Facebook. I'm actually more a part of like some groups there. Mm-hmm. Not that I am a very active part of it, but what I'm going to say is
exposure to Facebook leads me to believe that film Facebook is just like film Twitter, except a week behind.
And there's the fun of not having a character limit. So if somebody's upset,
fun.
It's all there.
Yeah.
But it also means that I can say whatever I want, and I tend to be kind of verbose, as we are learning at this exact moment, because I'm not done talking. So it would appear that like the one of the benefits, and maybe it's just one of the benefits in general, is that within a community, you do still, you find individuals and you find people that you connect with. Like, and I think when if people say, oh, I feel really connected to the community, chances are what they're actually saying is there were a handful of people within the community that I had a personal connection with, and this community, this setting, allowed me to find that person and connect with that person. But for the most part, you know, in that regard, sorry to bring this up again, but it's sort of like, it's entirely possible to go to a church, even just a mid-sized church, for years, and you actually don't connect with anybody. Like, mm-hmm. you will feel maybe some sense of connection with the church as a whole, but it's really when you start talking to individual people that you feel like you're actually part of the community. Even like, it's not about just being there. It is about having more personal connections. And so, and I guess in my experience, again, it's a very limited experience, of film Twitter, that's interesting. My experience with film Twitter is limited, but my experience with film Facebook is less limited, to such an extent that, like, I know that there's a guy who, named Taylor, who writes for a couple other blogs, and I know him and a number of other people through like a Facebook group that we're all a part of, and I know that he's moving to California, like as we speak, and so like he has reached out and said, "Hey, does anybody want to get coffee or something?" I know literally nobody out there, except he does know people out here, which is me and a few of the other people who said, "Oh yeah, I live in Los Angeles," and so I do think that there is, I think, based on film Facebook, again, to the extent that that exists, I think I can attest personally to the one-on-one connection that can come out of it. But my question then is, okay, there's, that has to do with like individual people finding commonality, likely not just in movies they like, but in experiences and philosophies. When it comes to the discussion of film as an art form, my experience with film Facebook has been a not wholly negative one, but one that I do find frustrating because, again, it simplifies and it reduces everything down to we don't like this or we do like that.
Right.
And I find that not particularly helpful. That was a long...
No, I think, I think you really got to some of the differences in what we're talking about, because I think maybe what you're talking about is what I would call the discourse or like aspect of it. And I think in general, what David's question is like, what does constitute a community? And can you say that there is a film community, which I can say, I think there is, and there's sub communities and groups within that. But there's different facets to the community. So you have, you know, the individual connections with you make with the people. You have, you know, quote unquote, the discourse or whatever you want to talk about in terms of talking about the culture, but also from, I think of cinema going as, well, or cinephilia as something that has a physical space. Mm-hmm. And when people come together in a physical space, that's part of the community. That's the scene. It's like if you're in the like punk scene or whatever, when you go to a show, it's like that's the community. That's the community space. And when you go to see a movie, whether it's a Repertory House with a lot of people that you see at various screenings, or if you're just going to the multiplex with friends, or even if maybe there's a new release that a lot of people that you know or a lot of people in your Facebook group have seen or on Twitter have seen, and then you all have kind of reactions to that separately, but then you can get together and talk about it. That's a communal space. I think that's what we're talking about when we talk about the film community.
Well, yeah, and it's also... You're right, it is a space, and you can engage with it even if you're in, you know, Bozeman, Montana, because if something plays in Rep at the Metrograph on, mm-hmm. you know, October 20th, you used to be able to find it on Filmstruck, or, you know, go to your library, you can take a look at that movie and you can engage in the conversation.
Right. If there's a retrospective that's happening, yeah. and maybe you hear about it, it's happening in New York and you hear about it and you say, oh, I'm really interested, and you're able to find those films, you can engage in that conversation at the same time it's happening in New York and, without being there.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think is, I don't know, exciting. I guess exciting about, you know, engaging, on Twitter in film Twitter, is that it isn't constrained to, oh, A Star Is Born came out 2 weeks ago.
Right.
We're going to be talking about A Star Is Born for a month, although we did kind of. A lot of people did talk yeah. about A Star Is Born for a month. But there is that, I guess, diversity of options there.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody would like to talk about The Nutcracker and The Four Realms, I'm more than happy to do so.
You don't even know.
Four Realms in this economy?
I mean, Nutcracker, eh? Realms? Holy shit. I've literally been making Nutcracker and The Four Realms jokes for like 3 weeks.
And that's why film Twitter is so good, because anytime a ridiculous movie title comes out, people will just riff on it like all day. And then if you see jokes, more jokes come. So if you're having a really slow day at work, or you're just having a crappy day in general, mm-hmm. if you just want to log on to film Twitter and read a lot of Four Realms jokes, they're there for you. And that's, wow. that's kind of nice.
That's exciting. I had no idea.
You're missing out.
Perfect example. I don't know when the last time anyone has thought about The Witches of Eastwick is.
It's.
I mean, the last time.
Yeah, but.
Yeah.
There was a meme going around around Twitter.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? It's one taught me
love. One taught me patience. One taught me pain.
I think it's the Ariana Grande.
I know that. I don't know The Witches of Eastwick song.
I was like. Oh, okay, threes. Oh, I know what I'll do. Michelle Pfeiffer, Susan Sarandon, and Cher in The Witches of Eastwick.
There you go. Perfect.
Boom. Slot it in. Immediately, I get Kristen in my mentions. I get Cam Collins
okay,
in my
so she
mentions.
Follows you.
Yes.
Huh. Not me.
Yeah. Do you want me to turn my phone on? I will follow you right now.
Oh, no, I'm not. I don't need
your
charity.
I'm Kristen.
Also, you don't want to follow him. It's very depressing. I have to, but you don't have to.
Okay. But now, when you're doing that, you picked the three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just put them in any order? Think about who taught you love and patience.
I did, because I needed to find a picture where Michelle Pfeiffer was all the way on the left teaching me love, because I am in love with Michelle Pfeiffer. That's uh-huh. that's part sure. of my Twitter brand. Thirst for hotties of the 80s.
So that's 100% your brand.
Yeah.
It's like guys being dudes westerns.
Yes.
And just like horny for like ladies who are in their 60s now.
And using yes. words like hottie. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I'm, on my
I'm,
show.
I'm raising the discourse here.
Okay. Do you think Diane Lane listens aboard. To this podcast?
Oh, that one I said.
Yeah.
Diane, are you single?
Motion carried.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Michelle Pfeiffer as an actress.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to...
It's getting spicy.
...to disregard their talents.
No, they're very talented.
Yeah.
But also hot.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with being talented and
yeah,
hot.
Yeah, so that's a roundabout way of answering your question. Yes, I did have to think,
okay.
you know, who
But
who
sometimes,
lines up
to go back to Tyler's thing about bringing up the discourse, as Kristen named it, and to bring A Star Is Born. So something all three of you guys said. Sometimes the discourse will work because, most of the... conversation around a movie does seem to be kind of
insular
or homogenous in a lot of ways.
Monolithic.
We feel this way, yeah. Mm-hmm. But then someone will use. I don't even know what this meme is from. It's the two like hairy motorcycle looking dudes yelling at each other.
Oh yes, yes, yeah.
I don't know what it's
from. Is that from like American Chopper or something?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. It's like the father and son. Yeah.
And so someone used that to make an argument that, which is how I felt about A Star Is Born, that that Jackson, the character, disapproves of Ali's pop star phase. The movie doesn't disapprove.
Uh-huh.
And because a lot of people are saying, mm-hmm. like, that's a knock against the movie, is that it doesn't respect...
Depiction,
it,
endorsement, that kind of thing?
Yes, and I'm like, no, that's Jackson. I don't think the movie has a problem with her singing about how the dude's jeans, the ass looks in the jeans. I like this song. It's a good song. And someone used that, and I was like, I get why memes work. I get how that you can actually use the structure for... If you're not just... plugging in random shit like Jake did. If you're actually using the structure to cut through the bullshit, the main thing can really work.
Right. And it sort of cuts through, and instead of, you know, engaging in a back and forth argument with like some bot or something, you can just post a meme and then people are like, oh yeah, that's a much clearer way to express your feelings. And I like that you can make a point that way, and it's just as valid, because I think in a lot of ways Twitter and even sometimes Facebook or other social media platforms are really not the best way to engage in a conversation, because I think when you're talking about the finer points of any piece of art, you want to kind of be face to face. Ideally you want to do that old-timey old person thing where you go out to cup of coffee after a movie and talk about it, but people don't really.
You come on a podcast.
Yeah, right. I think that's the 21st century equivalent. But
you hop aboard.
But memes and communicating in GIFs and just this sort of like shorthand, almost like hieroglyphic mishmash language of all of these signs and signifiers for some reason sometimes seems to get at the truth of what you want to talk about.
Yeah.
In a better way than just, you know, a five paragraph essay on Facebook where the next person gets really mad and says, you are wrong and here's why, ABCD. Right. Sometimes I feel like that's not as constructive as maybe just like joking around.
Yeah.
Like, because the meme is like the blade that pierces the chainmail.
Yeah.
Right. It actually can get through because people are actually paying attention to the memes,
like,
and not at this point you're,
and it's good natured.
Five paragraph thing needs a TLDR at this point for people.
Like, I mean, when I saw The Revenant, I knew it was a piece of shit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But what good is my tweet saying, God, that was such a piece of shit, gonna do? However, I can go on Frinkiac, get a gif of Jebediah Springfield wrestling a bear, flashing reenactment, and just say The Revenant and credit it to Inarritu, and I know that it'll do the exact same thing, and it might make a few people laugh.
Yeah, I think it's more good-natured, and so I also think that contributes to people getting less upset, maybe, is if you're communicating in this sort of like shared language that people have, rather than a lot of times, and I'm not on Facebook anymore, but a lot of times when I was on Facebook, it would be more of like a personal screed that people would just kind of go on.
It's almost as though, like, with memes and maybe even with tweets, because it is limited, that there's an unspoken agreement that, okay, we all know that this is by nature reductive.
Mm-hmm.
So since we know that, we're not going to accuse people of being reductive. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have the option of five paragraphs and you instead choose to just say, you know, three sentences about why something's a piece of shit, people be like, oh, this person's not putting enough thought into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I worry that I don't want to make this all about Twitter, the whole episode, because we're going 45 minutes, we're still talking about Twitter. And we talked about Jason Blum for a little bit, but that's it. But I do worry that, the four of us sitting at this table, we know that it's by nature reductive, but I do think there are people who are so entrenched in Twitter as discourse that they do forget that.
Here's my comparison to that. My experience, again, limited experience as a teacher right now. I'm teaching a college class, but I'm also teaching middle schoolers. And I'm sure I've mentioned that when I have asked them, like, how many of them want to be filmmakers, there are a few that very enthusiastically raise their hands, and good for them. And when I ask what are some of your favorite movies, they list YouTube channels. And so they're thinking in terms of, like, not that those are movies, but they're not movies. Right. But they like, I feel like they missed the question.
No, but categories to them are more fluid because they're kind of 12 years old, right?
It's all content now, David.
Yeah. It's, okay. I should have said, what's your favorite content? Yeah. Oh, I feel bad even.
Well, you got to split it up, branded, not branded, hashtag ad, you know.
But I do feel like there's, it's, and I don't necessarily, I don't blame the kids for that, but it's this idea, it's like these, they're watching 10-minute videos, they're not seeing very many movies, they're thinking, and because they're watching these videos, they're thinking in terms of YouTubers, and not even films, and certainly not filmmakers, they're thinking in terms of, like, the number of them that said, I want to be a YouTuber. Again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think there are people for whom, like, I enjoy YouTube. But I also recognize where it fits in the larger conversation about visual media, whereas for some people of a certain age or who've only been exposed to certain things, that's all it is. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that is part of their conversation. And along those lines, maybe something like Twitter or memes, that is the furthest extent of their film vocabulary. But I might be overly simplifying there.
Now I want to move on. Out of Twitter, I'm going to use this as a chance to do a little break here. I have two corrections that I need to issue from last week.
Okay.
Last week, I said Blue Sky when I meant Illumination.
Right.
We're talking about animation studios.
Yeah. You mistook a bad company for a mediocre one. That's very important.
So, yeah, Illumination makes the things that make my ears bleed. Blue Sky makes the movies that I forgot.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Exactly.
Oh, Ferdinand. Right.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, Blue Sky. I didn't mean to insult you that much. I only meant to insult you a little bit. Another thing. So speaking of your students, last week we were both like a little, I don't know, not bewildered, but we thought it was remarkable that your students considered Back to the Future an old movie. And I was thinking about it. I was like, you know what? Back to the Future is an old movie. It's 33 years. An old movie.
Yeah, it's, and that, it, for me, if you're a film fan, I feel like anything pre-1940 is old. Like, I'm comfortable saying it's old.
When we were in middle school,
I know.
Like,
look, if you're in middle school, Back to the Future is twice your age. That's an old movie.
I'm talking about my college students. My middle school students
don't. Oh, I thought you were coming to your
middle school students. No, my middle school students don't
even know Back to the Future. It's still almost twice their age.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I still think with the college students, they're right. It is old. Anything over 25 years old is now an old movie. That doesn't mean that it's less important.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's okay for us to say we don't need to hang on to, you know.
Yeah. I think that's,
Wedding Singer doesn't need to be new forever.
It's misplaced. It's misplaced nostalgia. Right. and a refusal to realize that we're all getting older.
Yeah.
I mean, Back to the Future, I watched that when I was a kid, but it came out before I was born. Do I think it's an old movie? I mean, not really. But I wouldn't be upset if someone who was 19 said it was an old movie, because to them it is.
But see, if I were you, I probably wouldn't think of it as older. I think anything that came out before I was born, I do think of as like,
right. I guess I guess it depends on what you're talking about in terms of old movies. Like the phrase "old movie" could really mean anything because it's old in comparison to your age.
Yeah,
right.
When you start throwing around terms like classic movie or classic Hollywood movie or things like that that actually are set in a temporal space. Well, classical Hollywood movie would be set in a temporal space, not necessarily classic movies. But yeah, that's a different name for that. But I think this whole thing about, you know, what is an old movie and what get off my lawn and all this kind of old man yells at cloud stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's a little bit like, just chill out. It's fine.
I don't feel personally insulted or anything that. David, while you were busy being part of the, you know, the film, the online critic society and the various things. Look, I was getting my master's in cinema and media studies from UCLA. It's not a big deal. The point is, when you're doing stuff like that,
and
now you're an academic as I am.
But only one of us got the press release from the Israeli Film Festival.
That is true.
And one of us has a master's degree from USC, clearly superior to UCLA.
Isn't that cute? My very first day of class at UCLA, I walked onto campus. I'm moving on. This is facetious. I don't give a shit. Literally my first day, I walked onto campus.
Is this the Coppola story?
It is the Coppola story. Have you heard it before?
Yeah, you told it on the podcast.
Which one?
I don't know. Where you just saw him like in a van or something?
No.
a van down the river?
Down by the river. Sorry. That was Matt Foley.
I could see him both actually living in a van,
gentlemen.
Like, like on his vineyard or something like that. But,
his vineyard.
All right. How long we've been going? Because that's how we should.
No, we need
Coppola
to talk
makes
about
bucket
stuff.
Wine.
But no, I do think that it's I don't think it's about like age, and it's not a thing that I'm bitter about. Like for some reason, I think of because I've been like teaching film history. Like I think of anything like from the 1960s as modern. Like anything that did away with the Hays Code and features like profanity, features stuff that we could see in movies now. I don't necessarily mean CGI. I mean, as far as content and story, I have a hard time thinking of that as old because
I think that's a great point. But I think that also as an educator, it's your responsibility, and not just yours, but the responsibility of everyone who's in the position to teach film history or media history, to sort of make those designations. Mm-hmm. And say, this is modernity. We're getting into post-modernity. Here's what these terms mean and how they apply to films, and to let the kids realize that they're part of a historical moment, just like everybody else that came before them.
Yeah.
And there are precedents, and there is, you know, history to things. The names of things are not necessarily arbitrary. A lot of them come from production histories or things like that that you have to integrate into just, you know, this isn't black and white and this isn't color.
Well, and that's part of the thrill of discovery when you're going through quote unquote old movies, right? Yeah. Like, why is this 1931 Barbara Stanwyck movie so racy? Like,
And then this late 50s movie is like everyone, nobody is touching each other, and it's
And that's when like those distinctions start to crumble. But I do think you kind of do need that general framework when
When I designed my initial curriculum, I divided like film history into four eras, and it was silent, classic, modern, digital, and even that, I feel like you could probably break them up even more. But that is about where I felt comfortable, like. Like in starting in like in the late 80s, like when the computer became a vital part and then eventually the vital part of filmmaking. Sure. I feel like that's,
you guys are talking about like more academic stuff, but you got me thinking about like just sort of like personal, like subconscious things that I like, lines that I draw. And I think subconsciously, and I'm only really thinking about it now, I feel like the Steadicam made movies look so different that I do, like, there is a divide between, like, The Godfather and Rocky. Like, even though they're only 3 years apart or whatever, like, Rocky's like a Steadicam movie, and it feels much newer to me than The Godfather does. And I would wonder if to, like, college students or whatever, digital intermediate and that sort of, like, digital color timing, it really changed the way the movies look. And I'm wondering if a movie that hasn't been color timed digitally to within an inch of its life, like every movie is now.
Yeah.
If it's like asking someone or younger than us or whatever, who's not into movies, to watch a black and white movie, it must look so different.
But that's what I'm talking about the naming of things and the designations of eras are based on technological innovations, production history. You know, you have, you know, like the boom mic or the Steadicam or, you know, matte paintings into CGI. It's like these are the things that actually make movies different and move the kinds of movies that you're seeing forward into a new era, because it's hard. A lot of kids go into learning about movies thinking that it's art, and it is art, but it's also commerce and industry. And you have to teach the commerce and industry part because that's how you get the art part. And it's hard to make that connection. And that's a lot of what people, but that's the film community too, is the laborers, the people,
gearheads.
The gearheads, the people that do the mics, the people that carry the lights. That's
Tyler
the film
and I
community.
Went to, well, what Tyler did his undergrad. That's right, what exactly. You guys say. What Tyler did his undergrad, where I went to college. That's my Midwest.
I appreciate the St. Louis in there.
It's a film school, but it's really more of a trade school. I mean, there are some like critical thinking type in history classes, but really it's a, like, this is how you make a movie.
Yes, they wanted to get hands-on experience.
Yeah, and so I remember guys talking, they'd refer to themselves as, like, film nerds, but what they were talking about was, like, what, you know, kind of, they're talking about C-stands and, like, I'm forgetting the names of things now, the light thing you put in front of the
meter,
the light meters, yeah, and all, like, all the technical, like, they're mm-hmm. essentially like I jokingly called them gearheads, but they thought of themselves as film nerds.
Yeah, right, that's interesting.
And I was just at a screening last night, and it was a screening for, like, the Society of, like, Composers and Lyricists, which is like a guild, and so we watched this
movie. Did Jason Blum have to say?
No, he wasn't there. we just watched a regular wide release movie, but everyone in the audience was a composer or a lyricist or something to do with music rights or music supervisors, something like that. And so all of the post Q&A questions for the composer of the film were very technical. It was, you know, how did you mic the piano? What kind of things did you do? How was your working relationship with the director vis-a-vis coming up with the cues? And when I think it's very illuminating to go to different guild screenings or different society screenings, if you have the ability to do that, or even just to learn about how the people who make the movies think about how they're making the movies. Not everyone is thinking like a director, which I think sometimes is a fallacy when you as a viewer are thinking about it as a director. No. When really there are many different considerations for all of the different jobs on the movie.
Yeah.
And it's a good exercise. And this is like a film school exercise that we did to sort of like isolate certain parts of a film, like the score or the blocking or whatever, and just focus on that, because you can see the building blocks of how the film's put together, and you can see the many different elements that maybe if you were just watching with an eye towards quote unquote the cinematography that you would miss. And so when we talk about the film community, I think I don't want to get like a narrow vision of what the aims or the focus of the film community is, because I think the Society of Composers and Lyricists are as much a part of the film community with their interests about how the piano is mic'd than it is for someone who like really wants to have a vibrant repertory scene in Los Angeles. I think like the passion is there in both, and it's kind of a wide tent.
I was going to ask about that, and whether it be on Twitter or otherwise, like, and when we talk about the community, I instinctively think in terms of watchers and commentators as opposed to contributors, you know, whether they be directors or writers or actors or whatever. As far as you guys who are more involved, is the community big enough to incorporate that, or does the involvement of directors who might take comments personally or whatever it is, does that change? Is that a different type of community than the one we're talking about?
I mean, I think there's intersections on film Twitter. Mm-hmm. There are filmmakers on film Twitter that are a part of it, writers, directors, producers, things like that. A lot of those people maybe have dabbled in criticism themselves, and so there's kind of an overlap there. I think it is a little dangerous, if you're a critic and that's what you do as your job, to be familiar with filmmakers, because I think that there's always the, I don't know, you can fall into traps that way. And but I also think that people in the industry are usually too busy making whatever it is they're making to really engage with whatever is going on, whatever the newest release is.
Yeah.
But I think there is some overlap, and a lot of people that work in the industry are cinephiles. Mm-hmm. It's just they're doing other things. Mm-hmm. And I definitely see friends of mine who are filmmakers, you know, at repertory cinema screenings, but they're usually there, you know, they're there on their nights off when they're not shooting. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a different kind of lifestyle if you're a writer rather than if you're a person in production.
Well, I also think we're back at Twitter again, but
sorry.
I think there are filmmakers who participate in Twitter or in just the general sort of like online film community who are actually just participating as part of the community. I think Sean Baker is someone that I read his Letterboxd reviews. Like I like him, but then I think there's also a lot of people who get on Twitter because they think like, all right, this is the me show now. Like,
right.
I'm on Twitter. Let's give them a thrill or something like that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. I don't like that because Tyler and I used to be part of an online comedy nerd community that had a certain message board that I loved for comedy fans. And there were certain comedians who would post regularly on there, and some of them were great. And some of them were treating it like it was their fan site, and it would always drive me crazy.
I think you can tell when it's disingenuous and when it comes from a place of sincerity. And the fact that you will see Sean Baker around town just going to movies, I think, is a testament to that. You'll see Edgar Wright going to movies. You know, you'll see these guys if you live in L.A. It's like, you know, you can tell when they're just here to watch a movie, not to promote whatever they have coming up.
Yeah. I was, this is months ago now, but I texted Jake that Bogdanovich was behind me in line for an Ernst Lubitsch movie at the Billy Wilder.
We all have a Bogdanovich story.
Yeah. Actually, I have a story from AFI Fest a couple years ago. I was in line and I had my bag from one of the TCM fests, and it was a bag that had a list of all the movie titles that had played at TCM that year, and one of them was Stagecoach. And the woman in front of me in line, we had been talking because this was like a gala screening, so we're in line for like 90 minutes, so we're just talking about whatever. And then she was like, "Oh, I see your bag, you know, my dad made a documentary about that." And I was like, "Oh, about which one?" And she was like, "Oh, about the director of that movie." And I'm like, "John Ford?" And I'm like, "Your dad made a documentary about John Ford?" And then in my mind, I started to kind of implode because I realized that I had been talking to Peter Bogdanovich's daughter for like 90 minutes. And then I immediately became a creep and I was like, should I say, "I know who your dad is and I'm a big fan"? No, I shouldn't say that. So I just like pretended to be like a real person. And then, you know, it was just like really a really weird LA thing because she thinks I'm like a regular person that maybe just likes movies to a normal extent and not, you know, wants to make a bunch of, I would just wanted to make a bunch of ascot jokes or like, "Where's your dad now? Is he going to come and see this movie? Like, can we hang out?"
Or more importantly, is your mother Polly Platt? Because that is also so awesome.
It's true. And I didn't ask, but I assume yes.
Yes.
I don't know, but that's you know, if you're in line at a festival, you literally do not know who you're in line with in LA. So you better watch it.
My favorite story of, which listeners have heard before, but I love it, about cinema going in Los Angeles and the weird things that happen. I was at, this was over, just like 11, 12 years ago. The Egyptian was doing a triple feature of Hammer horror films that you've never heard of. They're the like weird one-off, like that are tend to be like a little grittier and nastier. And it was a really great day of a triple feature. And they didn't have anyone to introduce the movies, but Joe Dante was there. And he was like, and I guess he said to them, he's like, "Oh, you don't have anyone to introduce this? I know all about these movies." And so in between each movie, Joe Dante just stood up and talked to us about it. It's fucking great.
It's like, "Hey, my name's Joe. I'm going to talk about these movies."
When friend of the show Jason Egan and I went and saw Crimson Peak at the NoHo 7, Jim Beaver was in the audience, who's in the movie, and so afterwards we're just like looking at him, and it's like, the fuck, what's he doing here? Like, could he not make the premiere or something? Or I don't know what's going on. It was very strange.
He wanted to see it twice.
Yeah, maybe he just loved it and like wanted, and he was there with his family, so maybe he wanted them to see it or something like that. But it was very nice, and so we. He was like, "Yeah, sure, what the hell." So we went up and said that we really liked him in the movie and that we loved Deadwood.
Did you guys read that AV Club interview with Jim Beaver?
Is that Random Roles with him?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's so great because he talks about like, because Game of the Thrones, like a huge Deadwood fan, and that's how he got the role. And like at the table read, he could hear at the end of the table, didn't realize he could hear him, Tom Hiddleston being like, "Hey, Guillermo, who is this?" And then Guillermo del Toro was like, "You haven't seen Deadwood?"
It's fantastic. And then the DVD box set appeared in Tom Hiddleston's trailer.
Yeah. So it's Guillermo del Toro loudly telling Tom Hiddleston and Bea Vashikovska what a great actor Jim Beaver is. That's fucking awesome.
I mean, it's not wrong.
By the way, the fact that the Deadwood movie is happening is like,
we'll see.
So we've got, exactly. It's the new other side of the wind for me. Like, I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay, let's get back into, so now I want to talk about, which is more about the IRL community.
Yes, mm-hmm. Let's go there.
Because I think this is where my distrust comes from, or not distrust, my lack of trust, which is not the same thing. in communities because I
I get it. I get distrust. It. Yeah, yeah.
Sure, I just don't have a lot of
you inactively distrust.
Yeah, I don't put a lot of stock in most other people's opinions about movies. And part of it is because I didn't get into movies because I had an older sibling who was into movies, or like wasn't me and my friends sitting around talking about movies. Like I got into movies because I was a lonely kid who didn't have any friends, and I, you know, occasionally would.
And you want to preserve that?
Yeah, I would occasionally drag.
Don't people kill see, that little lonely child.
But like I would occasionally drag people to see a movie. But if it wasn't like I had a friend who was like wanted to go to see an Antonio movie that was playing at Webster University, I would tell him and he would say, I guess that's what we're doing on Friday night. So like, I didn't really, until I met Tyler, I didn't really have a friend that I talked movies with. And even then, for the first year or two that Tyler and I knew each other, we only saw each other once every few months.
Yeah.
And so I've never really.
Jake, why? Why did we only see each other every few months? I just want to see how much of a fan you are, since you're going to throw my fucking stories back
at me. You're the Coppola story.
Yeah.
Because you lived in different places and there was like theater?
Yeah, it was a theater thing. We had rehearsals.
I'll accept
that. He was backstage. You were on stage.
That's right.
All
right.
You got it.
Wow. Second best actor?
What are you, a stalker? How do you know all this?
I've been listening to this podcast since I was like 13 years old.
First off.
That's disgusting, first of all.
Okay, I'm insulted.
No. It's disgusting how young he is.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely.
No, we all hate you.
Well, yeah, fuck this kid.
No,
yeah.
14 years old.
Oh, my God. Oh, so much better.
But no. And look, the play that I won Best Actor, State of Missouri, in the year 2004 was not Bus Stop. That was just the state show. And David being a part of that was also a big honor. I'm saying, you know, there was no better sound man in the state.
Well, there was at least one better.
Oh, right.
Jeff.
Oh, Jeff. We all knew you did the work.
Jeff didn't accidentally play Tom Waits instead of Winston.
Theater, also a community.
That's true, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about how I, to this day, have very few friends that I see regularly that I talk about movies with.
Let's talk about that, because what you were describing, your childhood, I think is a very common childhood for people that grow up to be cinephiles.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So where did those people make the jump to actually having friends?
Well, they find each other on the interwebs. Am I wrong? I mean,
I had friends growing up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, fuck you.
I wouldn't force them to watch movies, but like part of what I also kind of get from the film community is just being able to say, even to someone who may or may not be interested, oh my God, I just saw this great movie.
Yeah, that I never thought I'd be able to see.
Yeah, I'm looking at Tyler's collection.
Yeah.
I mean, I also am someone who's really into physical media. So for me, it came from, like, part of my cinephilia growing up was, all right, I have like six friends over. I'm going to go through my collection and be like, here are five movies that we can pick from. What do you guys want to throw on? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think.
So you were the introducer. You were the person.
I very much liked to be the curator.
Oh yeah.
Would you say you like to hold court? Are you a court holder?
I've held court.
He's a bit of a court holder, if I can say so.
Would you say that, because I also had friends, but I do think that there is, in my experience,
let me be clear. I have also had friends.
Yeah. I'm not like.
I'm sorry.
Can the court reporter read that back?
But I do think that regardless of like if you were a lonely kid or if you had friends, the love of film does eventually isolate, but not in a bad way. Because my friends liked going to movies, I liked going to movies, and then there came a moment when I realized and they realized that, like, oh, okay, I like this more than they do.
Right.
And the stuff I like is different than what they like.
Did you read Mindy Kaling's book, Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? Mm-hmm. You guys?
No, I didn't.
She has a moment about that, like about being a comedy person, because movies and comedy are things that everyone likes.
Right.
Only certain people realize at a certain point, like, I like this more than other people.
Right. I think it's like when you start going to things by yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't know if since you were a lonely kid, but I've been going to movies by myself like since I was 13, because I would see all the PG-13 movies.
And but just, how did you just, get that? I wasn't able to go until I had to.
I would walk to the theater if it was close enough, or I'd get a ride. My parents would drop me off. I had a little bit of money and I wanted to go see the films that were up for Oscars, which were mostly PG-13 movies because I was pretentious and 13. Mm-hmm. And I just started going by myself. And it was like I knew it was like weird societally, but I didn't feel weird about it. I was just this is what I want to do. And if there's nobody that wants to go with me, it's like, that's fine. But obviously from a young age, it's like, okay, I get it. Like there aren't, like, I'm not going to the mall to go to a movie, like, with my girlfriends. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to see, like, A Beautiful Mind by myself with 70-year-olds.
Tapped into something for me personally, which is why I am not as precious about the theatrical movie-going experience as a lot of cinephiles. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't walk. There was a movie theater I could walk to. I couldn't get a ride. I was one of four kids. My parents had other shit to do.
They
were going to take me to the movies. That just wasn't an economical use of their time. And so I fell in love with movies on VHS in the basement, because I would get my mom to grab something from the grocery store video counter, or I'd go to the grocery store with her and pick something out. Yeah. And so that's the green light I'm trying to get to steer my boat toward, is to get back to being alone in the basement, watching Who's Harry Crumb on VHS.
Yeah, the basement.
Jaws 2.
Mm-hmm. In Denver, we had an unfinished basement, but we still had like a couch and a TV down there. Yeah. And, you know, when I think of my own cinephilia, I do think of it as a lonely thing. I think of me as a 15-year-old watching all the President's Men alone in my unfinished basement. I mean, like, no. In retrospect, it's like, how did I have friends? If this for me was a fun activity.
Kristen's Angelina, do we need to explain what a basement is?
No, I know what a basement is, but I'm just surrounded by Midwesterners or whatever. It is interesting. Because it's not like
Heartlanders, please.
Okay, whatever the preferred appellation is, it's fine. But I mean, I did.
You call me an Appalachian?
No, Appalachian.
I'm joking.
What a funny man you are. I mean, we did go to Blockbuster and stuff like that. But I'm from the suburbs. It's not like I'm from Bollywood or anything like that. I'm from the suburbs of Southern California. So we went to Blockbuster. I had a little tiny. My mom let me have a little tiny TV with a DVD VCR player, which in high school I would just watch DVDs like all night alone in my room. Basically, I watched, for some reason, I watched the Orson Welles Othello. I really don't know why. I got that from the library, I think. Maybe. I mean, we were big library goers when I was a little kid. And then once I got older, I realized, oh, I can get movies from the library. I should definitely do that. And then so I had my own room and I was just, or I would just watch DVDs on my laptop. Like that's how I watched, TV on DVD. That's how I watched Deadwood and a lot of other television shows. And it is I think for me growing up, it was partly going outside on my own to see movies in theaters, but also just watching at home, or I'd watch with my siblings, or I'd make them watch it with me, or I would make people in my high school class watch movies with me. Like I took a movie class junior year, which was basically just, like a write-off class that people would sleep through. But I made my friends watch Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with me because we were writing a paper on it and they had fallen asleep during the movie when we were in class. And I said, oh, it's okay. I'll bring my copy. Uh-huh. And so we went over to my friend's house and I was like, guys, this is actually a really good movie and you'll actually really love it. And they just all fell asleep. And I just watched it again by myself because it was so good. And I was trying to get these people that I really loved in my life to like understand that this is something that's great and they could share it too, but they just like weren't there, but it's fine.
I didn't have a film class in my high school, but I did have a junior year AP Lit, I think, or AP Language. I can't remember what it was. We had a group assignment, which was to read a book and watch the movie adaptation and do a compare and contrast. I honestly don't remember which movie I did. What I do remember is there was a group of girls that I knew who were having trouble picking a movie, and I was like, have you ever heard of a book or a movie called Wild at Heart?
So wow.
They actually ended up doing Wild at Heart.
Oh my lord.
And again, I went them by VHS.
They didn't need like parental consent for this? I mean,
we're juniors. Yeah.
All right.
The other thing, I still remember what movie I did, but the other thing I remember about that class, and we'll move on, this has nothing to do with that topic, but it's a funny story. It was well known in my school that my teacher of that class had gone to college with and briefly dated Brad Pitt, because Brad Pitt went
holy
to
moly.
He grew up in Missouri and went to college at Mizzou in Columbia, Missouri.
Another Heartlander.
And someone did A River Runs Through It. And so they're showing clips as part of their presentation, and Mrs. Harmon like looks around and realizes that the entire class is just kind of like looking at her. she was like, it was like two dates and he wasn't as good looking back then. But that's another memory from
the
class.
Can I just tell one story about that doesn't really have to do, doesn't connect to your story at all, but you just reminded me of it. Mrs. Rausch, a science teacher that I had my senior year of high school, she could basically get away with anything she wanted, because at one point she was actually fired for no good reason and had to sue to get her job back. Anyways, wow. She could do whatever she wanted. She decided she wanted to teach this class called Social Implications of Biology. And in that, she would often show a lot of movies, one of which was Forever Young with Mel Gibson about cryogenic freezing. And as you may remember, there is a shot of Mel Gibson from behind. It is a wide shot, so you are getting a full view of Mel Gibson. Mrs. Rausch decides to pause on that frame, leave it up there for a while, and remark, damn, look at that. You bounce a quarter off those buns. And then just press play and let it settle over the room.
That is no way to watch a movie.
Yeah, she. I would say she's not a part of the cinephile community.
No. She's got her own thing going.
good for her, though.
Mrs. Rausch was a badass, and I hope she's doing well.
Shout out.
Do you know I broke my own not talking during a movie rule the other day when I saw The Old Man and the Gun with my wife. And there's a part when a newscaster says, I think it's safe to say for now, the Over the Hill gang is retired. And I very quietly to my wife said, good one.
You're allowed one every few years. Yeah. I think you got it. I did actually, all this talk of Los Angeles and the heartland and that kind of thing. And by the way, I'm actually from California originally. Let's not forget that.
Coastal elite.
I am from the heartland of California, which is middle California.
Where are you from?
Outside of Bakersfield.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Hell itself.
Taft, California.
Yeah.
Formerly named, quite literally, Moron. That was its original name.
Oh, yes. I think I've heard of this place. Yeah.
But anyway, so I did have the question, as far as like being a film fan and then finding, you know, the kindred spirit in real life, I wonder how many people have had that happen who have not moved to a big city or a city at all. Like, I feel like if you live in a smaller town and you love movies now, because of streaming and stuff, you can find great movies. You probably can't see them. You're probably not going to see them in a theater, but you can find them. But then how on earth are you going to find like-minded people in that situation? And so I do find myself wondering, like, how many genuine movie fans, like cinephiles, how many of them, if they live in a small town, how many of them stay there? And I don't know if this is something where I feel like the listeners are going to have to weigh in. Like, how many of you?
Yeah.
And also, this might be the exception to the rule, but film critic Noel Murray, mm-hmm. small town Arkansas.
Huh. Good for him.
Well, I mean, I think you are hitting on something that is often talked about within the broader online film community, which are questions of access, mm-hmm. questions of sort of certain regions having access to things.
Like geographic privilege is something that's talked in a wider conversation of certain privileges.
Which is why, I mean, things like Filmstruck were kind of.
I mean, it's not dead yet. It's still going.
Yes.
But what are things do we think?
Filmstruck, Fandor, movie, any streaming service in addition.
Movie the sponsor?
Yeah, movie the sponsor. In addition to physical media is the way that people who live in non-urban centers, and I don't want to be condescending towards that because most people don't live in urban centers, but it's just that's how they have their collection. And I feel personally I don't have a physical media collection, but also I live in Los Angeles, so I've decided because of my privilege to prioritize movie going in person. Because I have the means to do so, but most people do not have the means to do that. So it is, I think, a very, very relevant question of who is a member of the community, because how do we define the community? Is it defined by the spaces? Is it defined by the experience? Is it defined by people who have a collection of physical media? I mean, I think we have to bring people under that big tent in order to have the conversations, because not everybody has the means. And, you know, you get into that conversation as well with torrenting and things of that nature is who has access and who is in control of that access, which is another thing when there are corporate ownership of art. Who owns art and who is allowed to have access to that community.
Yeah, that's I generally don't. Well, no, I don't torrent at all. I have. It's been a long time.
You wouldn't download a car.
But I. but I also don't lecture for that reason. Mm-hmm. But there's an ongoing debate between me and my wife, because we, full disclosure on the podcast, we don't pay for HBO. We use someone else's HBO Go password, and I feel bad about it because I'm like, I like these shows. I want to support them, even though I know that only a very small fraction is going getting anywhere near them. And I can't. I have the money to do this.
Right.
I could just, you know, buy one pack less of cigarettes a month and I'd be fine. And my wife is like, fuck him, because she's much more anti-corporate than I am, which is saying something.
David, here's the way I look at it. If you watch something on HBO, you talk about it right here, and this is worth way more than your money. All right, you're talking about these shows. That's how I justify my own instances of this.
All right, so welcome to this week's The Deuce Corner.
you're an influencer, David.
That's right.
You get paid in influence.
Yeah.
Your contribution.
Sure. All right. So I think we've gone kind of full circle here. I'm actually talking about how going back to talk about how the internet can aid the community as opposed to just making it more toxic, which is sometimes my experience. I do want to ask, we've joked about Filmstruck a lot. What do you guys think is going to happen to the library? Is it just going to end up on a Warner streaming service? Are we like flipping out for something that we're just going to lose access to for a few months and then it's going to come back somewhere? Or is it really going to not be anymore?
To me, it just seems like the logistics of being able to move over something that extensive seems really unlikely. I mean, in terms of just having it be, say, a channel on the larger Warner streaming, whatever it may be, I think what you'll see is you might see a selection of Criterion, a selection of TCM, and kind of everything that sort of made Filmstruck special, really, like the level of curation and the level of how deep you could go into it. I don't think they're going to move it over, because I don't think, again, I agree with your wife. Fuck them, because they can just pull the plug at any moment.
Yeah.
And what recourse do you have other than clicking on a change.org petition, which you should all do? But I mean,
People should sign that.
Yeah.
Because it people will read it. So
yeah,
I think that you have to do everything that you can.
I did sign it, but I also want to say I also like give money to the Trevor Project and Southern Poverty Law Center. I don't want to sound like I'm in this privileged bubble where I'm like, this is the one thing that
I mean, I think just in the discussion of the film community is particularly relevant mm-hmm. right now. And in terms of being a community member, if you consider yourself that, what actually can you do? Movie theaters closed down. Mm-hmm. Can't do anything about that. Yeah. Streaming services closed down. What can you do? It's something that was in your life that is out of your control and is now not in your life. So I think it's important for people to feel that they can do something about it.
Yeah. I keep meaning to sign the petition, but I get so wrapped up in one of the 30 great films on Mubi all the time that it just slips my mind. I'm joking, of course.
Talk about corporate interest,
exactly,
folks.
Yeah, you don't get more corporate than Mubi. But no, it is something that... And I didn't even have Filmstruck, but even I understood the importance of what it was doing as far as having so deep a catalog, because going back to that discussion of like what makes a classic movie, well, according to Netflix, any number of things, movies that came out 15 years ago, you know, or maybe not that, but like 20 years ago are considered classics, and movies that are actually like older, whether we say they're old or not, I mean, can't be found there. And there really isn't anything on Hulu. Like the more sort of mainstream, like, you know, corporate streaming services, classic cinema doesn't, and international cinema doesn't really exist.
Amazon has a ton of stuff, but that's Amazon, a whole other ball of wax because they're evil too.
Yeah.
And also Amazon, unlike Filmstruck, does not care about the image quality and sound quality.
And the aspect ratio, which is a huge...
On HBO as well.
HBO, Hulu, Amazon Prime, calling your asses out. I could not find John Grisham's The Rainmaker in the right aspect ratio on any of them. It's a shame.
There's a difference between the... I mean, because the industry I work in, I know Amazon is just putting up what they're given with Netflix, whereas with HBO and your premium channels like that, they're demanding the 178 full frame. Be angry at them, but if the movie that you want to see in its original aspect ratio isn't available on Netflix or Amazon, be mad at the content provider, not at the streaming service.
Right, that's the problem, is that all these streaming services have more or less pivoted to original content in the past couple years, and that's, you know, you used to be able to find movies on Netflix. You used to be able to get movies from Netflix. You still can't get the discs. And that's why something like Filmstruck had to be created, is because the places where those films used to be, or they were only there in parts. And so there was this kind of panic among classic film fans, because it's, how are you supposed to have access to these movies? And it seemed like a little bit of a miracle that that Filmstruck was able to get the entire Criterion and put up all their own original content. And I think that's why it's hitting people so hard, is because it seemed like the solution to a problem, and now it's another problem.
I could see the Criterion collection as a singular unit moving to another streaming service, because it does have name recognition among certain people, and I'm sure Hulu was kicking themselves when they lost it to Filmstruck. But I feel like, I don't think Netflix would care, but I could see some other streaming service trying to snatch it up, because it adds an element of prestige, and they would know that there's a lot of people that would probably sign up for that streaming service solely for access to the Criterion Collection.
It's true, but the logistics of that are very, very difficult. I mean, Filmstruck was in the works for years before they were launched, and the launch was a soft launch for a long time while they were waiting to get on access to different kinds of platforms. And it was really just starting to get going in terms of people actually being able to watch these films, and in terms of the amount and variety of films that they were getting, were really just starting to get going the past 4, 5, 6 months. And so I think it being shuttered feels premature to a lot of people, because they were not fully up and running as soon as they launched. There were many things that they still had to work out. And so I think that's part of the reason that people are so upset. It didn't seem to be given any time to really find its audience.
Mm-hmm. I forget, was there a specific reason given? Like, it wasn't, they couldn't afford it, or
no, there was,
I think they took some learning lessons.
It was their statement was corporate BS. It was okay. Basically like, there was no reason said for them shutting down, but basically they were like going to take the lessons that they learned from Filmstruck into like other content creation.
I mean,
some bullshit.
My sense of the fallout afterward was just they kind of looked at a ledger, saw a big red number,
right?
And said,
yeah, they're just making cuts. It's just an accountant saying this is not being as profitable as it needs to be, and we're gonna kill it.
Yeah,
which is what happens when AT&T buys everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You know, it's. I mean, right. Well, now I'm just sad.
Yes, this was a fun episode. It ended on a very sad note.
Well, we could have been talking about a lot sadder things.
That's
so
true.
I'm glad that we at least got to talk about how great Filmstruck was for a while.
In the meantime, if you live in a city in which your library card gets you Canopy, you should have Canopy.
Absolutely.
That's a good one.
And actually just go to your local library.
Definitely.
Yes. If you don't have a library card, you should get a library card.
If your DVD player doesn't work, fix it. And go to the library and get as many free DVDs as you can.
Uh-huh.
It rules. It's so good.
It's the best.
And there are local video rental places in Los Angeles as well.
But I live when I was a kid, I couldn't walk to the movies. Now I can walk to a movie theater and a library from my apartment.
Yeah.
Living the dream.
Yeah. North Hollywood, baby.
No hope.
I mean, you know, we have that in Pasadena, too. And I can take the Metro to Videotech, which is in South Pasadena, and rent physical movies. So shout out to Videotech.
All right.
Now, real
shout
quick.
Out to Cinephile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there is a video store in my area. It's on Woodman and Van Owen, I believe. I think it's called Star Video.
Okay.
And it opened. It's not like it stayed open. It opened like 3 years ago. It opened after all these other ones closed.
Heck
and
yeah.
And it's going strong.
Yeah, support your local video store. Support your local library. Don't despair.
Yeah, and if you are in, a community that's not an urban center, organize, you know, try to see if there is a community out there,
or just if there are like three other nerds in your town, form a cine club and screen movies in your basement.
Definitely.
And actually you can probably work because you know even the smallest town has a library and they might have a way to project, like you could work
absolutely.
Something out with that as well.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Guys, let's all move.
Let's
all move to Arkansas with no hurry and start a film.
I don't like humidity, David.
No offense, I'm not going anywhere east of the Mississippi. Is that east of the Mississippi?
No, that's west of the Mississippi.
I'm not going anywhere
east.
I'm not going,
Arkansas,
I'm not going anywhere east of California.
There we go.
I'm not leaving Los Angeles ever.
That's too bad.
Coastal.
No, it really isn't. This is a great city.
Oh, it is, but
and the rest of the country is a nightmare.
Well,
sorry, no offense. Actually, yes, offense.
I mean, Chicago's pretty good.
It's
a little violent right now, but beyond that.
Let me tell you a little place called Las Vegas, Nevada.
That's right.
Nope.
A little hole in the wall.
The city that never sleeps.
Yeah, that's
nope.
Well,
nope.
That's not the one, actually.
No,
that's a different
no it's
city.
Not.
Are you sure?
I think so.
Okay. Las Vegas is like an aggressively like normal city. It just, it's like Scottsdale.
Yes.
But there's like a hole to hell in the middle.
Yes.
The little portal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You guys, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
You guys at home, you can find us at BattleshipRetention.com. You can email us at David@BattleshipRetention.com or Tyler@BattleshipRetention.com. You can follow us on Twitter if you're a part of film Twitter. If you're not, at Davey Pretension or at Tyler Pretension. I'm sorry. Tyler, your other podcast is called More Than One Lesson.
That's correct. And this week... what with developments in my teaching career... And by the way, I did want to... When I brag about like my master's and when I brag about being an academic, let me specify. I'm an adjunct instructor at the brand college. All right.
More brag.
Yeah. So I'm saying is, yeah, you should take me seriously. But anyway, and so with recent developments as far as what next semester is going to bring, I did an episode about my experience at UCLA and being a teacher and that kind of thing, and how exciting it's been. And so you can find, and yes, I do tell the Coppola story, which is why it's in my mind right now, because I recorded it last night. But anyway,
keep telling yourself that.
Where will find you guys if they're allowed to on the internet?
Jake, you want to go first?
Yeah, I guess you can request to follow me on Twitter at FilmBart, because my account is currently locked.
You're locked because you got a big boy job.
Yeah.
And
I'm in the club. He let me.
Okay. For some reason. Oh, I followed you during the podcast. Don't worry. You should have gotten a notification because I'm a big deal. No. I used to be sales on film. Now I'm sales off film, but it's sales_off_film, but don't follow me because I really don't talk about movies. You can't access me. Just text me if you know me. Otherwise don't talk to me.
Sounds great. Thank you for being here. Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.